Welcome to episode 4 with Senator Bob Smith. We appreciate each and every one of you for following along with the Baron 52 MIA mystery. During these episodes, we have made reference to documents important to Sergeant Machoff's case. Putting together the recorded episodes, I'm not able to insert the documents on the screens for you to read. Many documents are a few pages long, and we want to be sure you have access to them so you might review the evidence we present and form your own opinion of what is presented. In each of these episodes, in the description below, I have included a link where you can view each document that was referenced in the show. Again, we want to thank you all for following the story and giving us your support. So without further ado, let's dive into this episode.
He just turned 20 when his chopper went down. He searched for survivors, he wasn't found. He was missing in action, still is today. His buddies came back, but he had to stay. He can't remember a day without pain.
So today I'm thrilled to have with me today a distinguished guest who played a key role in one of America's most controversial and emotionally charged issues in American history. Joining us today is Senator Robert Smith, who served as a vice chairman of the Senate Select Committee on POW/MIA Affairs in the early 1990s. The committee was tasked with investigating the issue of American service members who were missing in action or were prisoners of war during the Vietnam War. Senator Smith played a vital role in this investigation, and the committee's findings continue to be a subject of debate and controversy to this day. Today, we're speaking with Senator Smith about the committee's work, its findings, and ongoing efforts to bring closure to this issue. Senator Smith, thank you so much for joining us today.
My honor. Glad to be here.
So I'll just kick it off. During the Senate Select Committee on POW/MIA Affairs, witnesses for the Defense Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency testified that they had received intelligence indicating there may have been a small number of American service members who were not repatriated at the end of the Vietnam War. The committee's final report issued in 93 did acknowledge that there were some evidence suggesting that live Americans may have been left behind, but the committee concluded that it did not have enough information to reach a definite conclusion. The committee also found no evidence to support the claim that large numbers of Americans were still being held captive in Southeast Asia. Senator Smith, can you describe for us the process that the committee went through to investigate the issue of the POW/MIAs from the Vietnam War?
Surely. I think just before going into that, I just want to say that one of the handicaps that we had was something that I had no control over were two things. One was cost, the cost of the committee. We had a certain budget. We couldn't exceed it, so we weren't allowed to do some things that I would have liked to have done. And then the time limit. We were timed. We had to wrap it up, and that put a lot of pressure on us to get information that we really didn't have time to get. We had to short circuit some information, and other times we couldn't even go into it, especially from the Korean War, and a lot of information Heather, you'll recall, we'll get into that, that letter that I sent to Senator Kerry, which indicated a whole lot of things that we weren't able to accomplish. But in terms of your question, John, it was pretty extensive as we could possibly be. I mean, it ranged from field trips, if you will, or trips to Vietnam. The committee, when I say the committee, somebody, either myself or Kerry, or usually Kerry and I went together, or other members of the committee, traveled to Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Vietnam, Russia, not to mention numerous meetings with government officials, private citizens in those states, in those countries, and also meeting with countless numbers of people in our government, in addition to family members like John and others who were constantly talking to my office about trying to extract information from the government, their own government, who wouldn't provide it. So we did that. We also had depositions, formal depositions, private conversations, secret meetings, people who didn't want to be identified, who remained anonymous, those who couldn't testify or wouldn't, one being a Secret Service agent. So it was an extensive process, but not long enough. I mean, I understand that there's a limit to what you can spend, and I understand there has to be a time limit, but the sunsetting provision clearly restricted us. And I would just conclude on this point. I think all of you here are insiders, and you know what I went through with Senator Kerry and Senator McCain. It was basically, it wasn't Republican Democrat. It was about those who felt that we needed to normalize relations with Vietnam and then establish diplomatic relations regardless, and that the POW issue was in the way. That was the Kerry McCain side, and then with my side, and a few other members like Chuck Grassley and Hank Brown and a few others who felt that we really needed to get the truth about what happened to our men. And that was my goal, and my only goal was to find out what happened to our men. And so that was my motive, but unfortunately, I was stymied on numerous occasions by Senator Kerry and Senator McCain. I guess you would say the majority, so to speak. I could not control the meetings because Senator Kerry was, the Democrats were in the Senate, were in the majority, and so he had the chairmanship and I had the vice chairmanship, so I was restricted in what I could do in terms of calling witnesses. Although I will say in conclusion, Senator Kerry was pretty fair to me. He allowed me to get most of the witnesses I wanted, but there were times when we were cut short, evidence was destroyed, and we can get into that later. All kinds of bad things happened. But anyway, that's pretty much what we were up against, what we tried to do. Our goal was to find the truth, period, wherever it went. We wanted to find it, and if we could get all the information that was available to get our government, as well as from the Vietnamese government and other governments who may have been involved, like the Russians. If we could get that, then we could go ahead and move on with diplomatic relations, but not before.
So what were some of the significant findings of the committee's investigation into the issue? What were some of the key findings that you had?
Well, one of the big ones was the so-called cluster issue, where we had a very professional staff of some of them former officials in the DIA and other prominent people who knew what they were doing, who investigated these sightings. And so we had them clustered on maps so that we could see in a congregated form where all these sightings were. And when you get 4,000 sightings across the board over all these years after the war, and then you begin to put them together and you see that they fit into a cluster, that they were seen several times by different people in the same location. And so that was a very significant finding in my view. Sometimes it was Garwood, sometimes they were people were making it up, and sometimes I felt they were valid. So that was one very significant finding, that there was a tremendous cluster that you could see all around the Vietnam where these sightings took place. But I think the one significant finding that there's so many, but I called it the high bar issue, which every time you would get a certain amount of information to establish so-called evidence of live sightings, they would, the government, our government, would raise the high bar and say, well, that's not enough. You know, it's like John, in the case of your brother and the Baron 52, you know, what you saw in that testimony that when I was questioning Destat, he was putting words in my mouth saying I was saying this and saying that when I wasn't. But, you know, they initially said that they had reports, you know, these reports of traffic saying that there were POWs being moved. And of course, that didn't come out until after we challenged them to bring it out. And then it went all the way to Kissinger, who was negotiating with the North Vietnamese at the Paris Peace Accords. So if they didn't think it was important, why the hell did it go all the way to Kissinger's level? So these are the kinds of things when I say high bar, no matter what happens. Then, you know, then Mooney didn't know what he was doing. Whatever, instead of trying to seek out and substantiate things, they tried to debunk it and drill it down and make it as hard as possible for the families and the committee to get the answers. So that was a finding that frustrated me, that we were lied to over and over. And that was one of the letters, Heather, that you sent me, where I pointed that out to Janet Reno, that we were lied to under oath, and I proved it. I had the proof. That was a significant finding. I also had several, which I'd love to go into, but I don't want to monopolize the conversation. But we can, that's at okay. some point, I'd like to go into the Garwood situation. I'd like to go into the, somewhat into the Baron 52, and also, and I know that's your main focus, and also the pilot identifier code. That is a very dramatic story that I don't think the public knows, because we couldn't get it all out. But just final point, to give you an idea of what I was up against, I wanted to bring Bobby Garwood in to testify about what he claimed to have seen while being over there for 6 years after the war was over, from 1973 to 79. And John McCain said he would, quote, unquote, destroy the SOP if you bring him in. And so Bobby was having some stability issues, you know, psychiatric issues. So I didn't want to put him through that. But we had numerous conversations with Bobby Garwood, with his attorney, and with him. And I believe Bobby Garwood. I believe he was telling the truth about what he saw. And then we, of course, went over there in Vietnam. I did. And visited Thoc Ba Lake on one of his sightings, saw the island, saw the prison camp, saw the generator that he claimed to have repaired, that the DIA said he didn't repair, and so forth and so forth. I could go on and on. But anyway, as far as findings, it's you know, we found that we were lied to. We found that there was a lot of evidence that we didn't even get into. There were a lot of eyewitnesses. There were a lot of live sighting reports. We certainly found out that the Vietnamese were not forthcoming, and they got their diplomatic relations without ever having to be forthcoming. And that was very troubling.
Yeah. One of the interesting things that you brought up there is how it went, that the issue with Baron 52 rising to the level of Kissinger. I located a CIA, presidential daily brief document that was 16 months later after the shoot down, where, the CIA was briefing the president of the United States on McKay or K that was shot down in Laos in May of 73. And then also the four that were prior to the ceasefire. So the president of the United States was actually being briefed over a year later about the four from Baron 52.
Yeah. And it's very obvious. And I know John Madoff, you know more than I do about this, but it's very obvious that was a very troubling incident in and of itself, and that it was an embarrassing incident because we were in Paris negotiating. I think we already had a schedule set for the first tranche of POWs to come home. I'm pretty sure of that there was a date set. And then this plane goes down, and it was an embarrassment to the U.S. government. And so what what Kissinger would have been concerned about was, here I am sitting here trying to negotiate to find out, get the list, if you will, of POWs that we're, that the Vietnamese are going to turn over to us and tell us how many they have. We may have four more. And this is an embarrassment. And so that's why it went right to Kissinger, that when that traffic came in, the signal. Yeah. And when that came in, that sent shockwaves through the system. They didn't know for sure. Yeah, they saw four bodies. They knew they had four bodies. They did not know what happened to the other four, including your brother John. And so that was shot right to the top, right up there, because Kissinger was there. He was in Paris, or was going, and he had to have that information. They couldn't keep that from him. Because he would have said, can you add these four guys to the list if they're alive? And so that had to go up there. And believe me, they would not have sent that to Henry Kissinger that high up, maybe even Nixon. I don't know for a fact. That's another story into why we couldn't get access to that. But they had sent that up there. They certainly wouldn't have done that if they didn't think it was accurate, at least at the time.
Well, Dr. Shields the other day told us that that it did go to Nixon. And he said that directly.
And I believe him. I believe him because I don't think Kissinger could feel comfortable going over and negotiating with the North Vietnamese on prisoner lists, knowing that there might be four more guys that just got captured when they weren't even supposed to be flying at the time, because the accords were being signed. They should not have been flying. And they got, unfortunately, the guys were doing their job, but it was the idea of sending them over there when the Paris Peace Accords were being negotiated. So it was an embarrassment. It was awkward, and they didn't know what to do about it, and they didn't know what the truth was. And as I pointed out in the committee, we had two rounds with the Stott on this and the DIA. They should have said, look, if they had come in and to the committee and say, look, ladies and gentlemen on the committee, If we went to the site, we saw four bodies, we don't know what happened to the other four, we had radio traffic that said that there were pilots being moved or pirates, whatever you want to call them, but they didn't tell us that. We had to extract that from them, bit by bit, by bit, by bit. And yet they felt enough, and I pointed this out in the committee, they felt strongly enough that they weren't going to sit on it. They bucked it all the way up. They ran Mooney into the ground, but they took Mooney's stuff and sent it all the way up to Nixon. So Believe me, they thought it was real. And whether it was or whether it was not, I don't know the answer. But we should have known the answer before we settled on that issue. We could have gone to the North Vietnamese and said, look, we lost a plane. We only found four. Where are the other four? You guys have them, If you have them, we want them with the rest of the guys. That was not done.
I'm just listening intently because I feel that there are people who have not been interviewed on the matter, and one of them being Dr. Kissinger, which I think we would know the end result of that interview if it did take place.
So, that, John, is an issue in and of itself. We tried, and Heather, the letter that you sent me, pointed that out, where I had asked, in a letter to Kerry, just as the committee was closing down, before we closed it, if we could conduct an interview with all the living ex-presidents because who were dealing with this issue. You know, Reagan did, Ford did, Nixon. And so we wanted to meet with them. Clinton was not in at the time. But we couldn't get that meeting. And then we tried to get Kissinger to come and testify, but we couldn't get him. And we did get some depositions from Mel Laird, who said we left guys. So we really don't know. We really never got these people to talk. But I think what it tells me, it's a major story in and of itself, that the presidents, we'll give the presidents a buy on it maybe, but at Kissinger's level, Kissinger and others who refuse to talk, that is a big issue in and of itself. In deference to the families and all they've endured, and the men who fought and died, and those who came home wounded, and those who came home as POWs, those people deserved to have Henry Kissinger come up there and say, whether it's about the Marin 52 or other POW, the issue in general, and say, here's what happened. Here's what we got. Here's what we didn't get. He never did that. And that to me is unforgivable.
Why do you think it is? In your last statement before that question, you talked about, you know, that we knew there were four that didn't, we had no evidence out of the search and rescue. Was it just purely for embarrassment and Watergate and all of the things that were kind of coming down on them? Do you have any other thoughts on why Kissinger, because obviously Watergate really, you know, wasn't Kissinger. He wasn't involved in Watergate. Why he didn't press harder for those four?
I've tried to answer that question. On one of my trips to Vietnam, and I can't remember the name of the Vietnamese official I met with. We met with a lot of top-level Vietnamese officials. I did, oftentimes without Kerry, because he didn't seem to be interested, but I would go off on my own and talk to some of these Vietnamese officials. And I think the guy's name is Phan, but I could be wrong on that, so I don't want to say for sure. But in a conversation that I had with a Vietnamese official who was right at the table with Henry Kissinger, he told me, he said, I sat right across the table from Henry Kissinger. I was one of the men, several Vietnamese officials who sat across the table from Kissinger. And he said, and I'll paraphrase him, I hate to say it, but he said, I don't recall Kissinger pushing hard or anybody on the U.S. side pushing hard for answers on the POWs. And I said, well, that's, I find that hard to believe, sir. Can you explain it? And he said to me, well, we provided a list. We had a list that of a list of POWs that we said we have. They took it. They being our side took our list. They gave us their list. And some names were on their list that weren't on ours and vice versa. But they didn't go beyond that. They didn't say, well, wait a minute now, you captured, we have films of this guy being captured in this province on such and such a date, and we have eyewitness accounts to that effect. Why can't we go into that? He said, they didn't go into it. They just accepted the list that was provided with that, with very little, I don't want to say no, but very little pushback or follow-up on some of these cases. And as you know, we had guys come back that were not on the list, and we had guys that didn't come back that were on the list of POW. So I got the impression, if I could summarize it, that the POWs were taken for granted. They didn't feel that it was a priority. They thought that they took the word of the Vietnamese of what the list they had. And even though our list was much bigger, we had as many as 500 additional possible POWs, about 500 less than they had. We had around 1,000, they had 500, and we took their list. And I don't think we challenged it sufficiently. We should have gone right down every list, every single person. We should have shown the facts we had, and we should have done, you know, not, I'm not saying we had to do all that prior to the other guys getting released, but we should have had a process in place that as these prisoners were being released, that we could, you know, that we could follow through. And the other thing that we were not allowed to do, or didn't have time to do, and was we were objected to by Kerry, was to interview a lot of the returning POWs. Mm-hmm. So we could kind of collate the information that they brought out and what they saw, what they didn't see in the prison system. Everybody's reports were pretty much private to protect, because some of the guys, you know, did some things that probably they wish they hadn't done, and I'm not blaming, I'm not making any editorial comment on that. They, who knows what anybody would have done in that situation, but they didn't want that out. So they kept it private, and only the interrogators or those who spoke to the debriefers rather than interrogators, only the debriefers were able to see and hear these guys, and that didn't go from there. But I talked privately to several POWs who were very concerned about a second prison system that never came out, never really materialized in the intelligence answers that we asked for.
You talked about Mooney. We talked about the message, you know, the intercept. What are your thoughts on that? They really discounted Mooney and what his thoughts were about the translations and exactly what was going on.
I look at that as this who was it? General Ty said the mindset to debunk. You get a report that says that pilots, radio traffic saying pilots or pirates, whatever you want to call them, were being moved. Nobody said they were RVNs. Nobody said they were Americans. They said pilots or pirates. Now, they didn't know anything about it. When I questioned the Stott, he couldn't tell me about any other planes that were missing. He couldn't give me any specifics about any other planes down in the area, just that pirates may or may not have been moved who were RVNs. Well, we don't know that. Maybe it's true. It could very well be true. But the way we had to push and pull and tug to pull this information out of them, we get the we get a report. They come in, they check the Baron 52 crash site. They come to the conclusion that there were four guys that eight guys died, even though they could only prove that four died. They said they were KIA. They should not have been KIA. They should have been MIA, as you know, John. And so then comes the radio traffic. And to me, if I'm in on the crash site and I'm the investigator and I don't see four bodies, I only see four, not eight, then I'm thinking, and then I hear this radio traffic, I'm thinking, whoa, wait a minute, what did I miss? And that's exactly what they did when they sent that message all the way up to Kissinger and maybe Nixon. They thought the same damn thing. They're not kidding. They're not fooling anybody. That's exactly what they thought. And then they came back after the fact, years later, and come back with all this other gobbledygook about Arvin, Ray, maybe somebody from the North Vietnam, South Vietnamese pilots and whatever. That all came later. That was not on the time at the time it happened. And they could have resolved it and maybe made it a lot easier on your family over the years, John, had they been more honest. Maybe they did die and maybe they did have information. I don't know. And unfortunately, they handled it wrong. They could have found that out. They should have gone to the Vietnamese in Paris. Kissinger should have said, wait a minute, we just lost this aircraft. We found four bodies. We don't know what happened to the other four. We want to investigate the site. We want you to tell us. You know what happened to them. Let's find out. Were they captured? Did they die? Where are their bodies? Let's settle it right now before we leave Paris. And that's what they should have done. They didn't do it. Instead, 20 years later, they put your family through all this misery all these years with doubts and, hassling you and giving you a hard time as you're trying to pry out the information.
Yeah, I'm going to insert that clip that Stott was giving you at that time where it was a friend of a friend.
Yeah.
Is how he had put it.
Mm-hmm. A friend of a friend.
Helicopters.
The assumption is that the only aircraft that were down, the only potential candidates for this were the crew of the EC-47 crew. Well, there in fact were at least three Arvin helicopters that were down in an area that would have caused the crew, if captured, to be evacuated through Vinh at the approximate time frame that we acquired this particular piece of intelligence. And in fact, a personal friend of mine, who was a pilot in the Vietnamese Air Force, is aware of a friend of his who was the pilot of one of those helicopters. He is aware that friend, in fact, was captured with his crew and was moved to North Vietnam. Now, we're in the process right now of trying to locate, to determine if any member of that crew survived captivity and is here in the United States. And if I can find them, we may have an answer to who this message really refers to.
But the point is, at the time you drew this conclusion, you didn't have that information. So what I'm saying is there is no other aircraft missing. We discussed the one that went down and the people were killed. There's no other aircraft missing in the area like this. What I am trying to get at here is you get a radio message. The message is self-explanatory. That's what it says. Then you start doing analysis on it. There's nothing about VIN in the message. There's nothing about VIN 240 miles away in the message. That's an analysis. That came later. The message itself speaks for itself. It says four.
The initial message. You noted that the second version of that message contained a footnote. I feel confident that the version that you have, the version of the first version of that message.
I can't read it.
And it also contains a footnote. And that footnote from the people who issued the report said that it came from Vin.
I know,
in their judgment.
Wouldn't it have been more honest to say to the committee when we asked you if there was evidence, if anybody survived Baron 52 a few months ago when you testified, wouldn't it have been more honest to say we had a radio transmission? We didn't believe the radio transmission or whatever but we think we also examined the crash site and we found that we didn't have any, based on the people who are at the site, we don't think anybody survived. And here's why. You didn't say that. You said there's no evidence.
Implicit in your statement is the assumption that I don't believe this radio transmission. It's also implicit that there's confirmed evidence that
everybody else believed it.
I believe that radio transmission. It simply does not relate in any way to this particular incident. It does not relate to this EC-47 coup. It could possibly be, I don't know who it is, but it could possibly be the crew members of one of those three Arvin aircraft.
So we don't know what happened to them. That's the point. We really don't know. And for you to say that there were other aircraft missing and you can't tell me who they are or how many people were on them, how many years later, 20 years later, you're telling me that there are other aircraft missing in that area, and it was within that 45-minute period that this message was reported. I mean, that's outrageous.
Let me quote from a letter written by the commander on the spot as to whether or not there was indications that people had bailed out of that. This man was much closer to the scene than I am from this location in time.
I'd like to know who the aircrafts were.
And I went in and I read the reports that are now declassified, that the ones that he was trying to compare it to were a few weeks before the shoot down of Baron 52 and a few weeks after the shoot down of Baron 52.
I'd like to hear from others, and I don't want to monopolize, but I want to say one thing about the spot, which is related but not directly to Baron 52. Later on in the hearing, I don't know if it was before the Baron 52 discussion or after, I can't recall. There was a discussion and an exchange between Destat and myself about the Ho Chi Minh tomb and about tunnels under the Ho Chi Minh tomb.
Is an underground, call it a facility, call it whatever you want, but there is something underground. We have an intelligence to that effect. It's been quoted, it's been cited before. And so the bottom line is, and I'm not going to beat this thing to death, but both of you are simply wrong. Now, you did quote, and I'm going to quote the quote that you left out, Mr. Destat, frankly, in response to a question regarding that facility. You said on page 127 in the testimony, quote, "I had freedom of movement throughout Hanoi and the surrounding area. I am very aggressive in seeking out a wide variety of contacts, formally and informally, throughout the city. I traveled around the city every spare moment I had. One of the things that I've looked into is the possibility of an underground facility of some sort, and I can't find any evidence that there is even a basement in any building anywhere in that country." That's the first quote.
And that happens to be true.
That is not true.
That is not true. I said that I have not found any evidence.
I'm telling you that is not true. I'm telling you that your statement is not true, that there is something.
He's saying he didn't find it.
That's fine.
Other than what I stated for the record in August, that we were aware of some air raid shelters there that we knew about. But that's not what we were discussing in my mind. We were discussing facilities.
Mr. Saito, you also said, as Mr. Destat has pointed out, that's not a closed or a denied area, speaking of the mausoleum area. We have talked to people who walk through that area. There's no reporting that would corroborate the construction of any underground facility in this time period. Mr. Destat, I might add that I've walked and ridden my bicycle down that street around the perimeter of the Citadel several times over the past 18 months. I've stopped and chatted with the guards at various entrances. I've chatted with people who work inside the compound. I've talked to civilians who run soup stands and other businesses. And I would say, looking at this issue in general, there are only a handful of reports which mention in one instance an underground facility, or in the other instance, the mausoleum. And again, Mr. Sido, if you would look at the map again, quoting you, you will see that the city of Hanoi has a very high water table. One who has been in Hanoi half day's rain will find the water level covering the streets. To propose that there might be an underground facility in Hanoi means to propose that you have to have a water evacuation system that would entail a great deal of construction. Certainly something that we would have been aware of with the coverage that we've had of that area, and I don't consider this report probable. Now, I realize that you can pull out quotes out of context. Nothing is meant to pull out of context. The context of this debate was that I had said that there were seven reports, that there were live sighting reports dealing with a possible facility underground. I never said it was a prison. I said that's what the site, that's what some of the reports said. But obviously, if there's an underground facility, it could be a prison. The reaction to both Mr. Destat and Mr. Seto to my questioning and to my comments, very, and I use the term arrogant manner, almost in a way condescending to this senator, was that I was full of garbage because there couldn't possibly be anything because the water table was too high. Now, that's what you said, and it was very clear what the intent of what you said was. And I'm telling you on the record right now, that as a base on the results of my intelligence data, that there is an underground.
If I could add.
And if you don't know that, then maybe you better go check it out.
We're very much aware of that.
Okay. Then let's get that record straight. Is there not a facility underground?
There is an underground space there that apparently contains generating and other equipment that relates to the mausoleum. Is that a prison? I think not, but nonetheless.
The point is, you can't have a generator underground, Bob, without having a facility under there, and in spite of the water table, it's there.
I think if I can interject here, because I think we need.
I just get sick and tired, Mr. Chairman, of this kind of testimony. It's counterproductive. Excuse me a second. It's counterproductive, and it is not fair to present this kind of testimony to this committee, and it's misleading. It's inaccurate, it's misleading, and it's deliberate.
And I've never said this publicly, but I'll say it because I frankly don't care anymore. I was given access under the Ho Chi Minh tomb by a Vietnamese official who was scared to death that he was going to be executed because he let me in there. So we got in. And Kerry was in there with me, so he knows damn well what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. He went in, and this guy said, you cannot divulge. If I take you under the tomb, you cannot divulge that you went in there. So we agreed to do that. So we never mentioned it. I didn't mention it in the committee that I was under there. Neither did Kerry. He and I were the only ones that knew other than two staff people. So we went under the tomb. And there was a tremendous system under there of tunnels and huge air vents and pipes and water pipe. I mean, you name it. It was looked like a subway system under there. And it was built by the Russian. Now, in the exchange I had with Destat, I asked Destat, knowing what I knew, he didn't know I was under there. So I said to Destat, I said, well, we have a lot of live sighting reports of people saying they saw prisoners, American prisoners, in tunnels underneath the Ho Chi Minh tomb. And you can find this if you look it up. I don't know where it is, but it's in there somewhere. He said to me, well, if you were anybody under there would need an aqualung because you'd have to swim because it's all underwater. And he laughed. And I sat back and I just kind of, I couldn't say anything. I couldn't say, well, I was under there and I know you're a liar. But he was lying right there on the spot, lying to me. And what they did, and this is important, very important to the system, they debunked every one of those live sighting reports because they said there was no tunnel system. There were no tunnels there. There was no access under the Ho Chi Minh tomb. There was no infrastructure under there. Therefore, nobody could see POWs under there because it didn't exist. And I can show you in report after report after report where they debunked witnesses and called them liars. They called them fabricators. Yeah, thank you. They called them fabricators because they couldn't see a prisoner where there was no such place to see. That's what they did. And that was just one example where I know this thought lied. And we could prove it, but I couldn't say anything.
Yeah, I think he also mentioned you'd have to get or you could go check with an engineer or something to the effect about having tunnels under there or something.
Yeah, I mean, it was elaborate. I mean, I've been, you know, you've been in, if you think about a subway system or maybe you're down in the bowels of an old building, almost like under the U.S. Capitol, there were all those pipes. And that's what it looked like. It was a network and there were rooms and doors and huge, huge pipes. I mean, big around as a oak tree. I mean, huge pipes, big. and everywhere, and rooms, and a very elaborate, clean network, all under the tomb, behind the tomb, and under the tomb. And we found out from this Vietnamese official that the Russians built it. I said to him, I said, where did this come from? The Russians built it, he said. Well, who knows? You know?
Wow.
The other one, there was, and of course, John knows about this, and I think you all do too. Pilots had pilot identifier numbers. And the only people that knew who what that number was the pilot, were the pilot, were the pilots, and somebody in the U.S. government high up in the intelligence community. So if they were shot down and they wanted to pass a message to the satellites above, they would take, they'd write that number in a way with sticks, perhaps rocks, anything that would look natural, maybe shrubs, so that the satellite can view it from the top, and they'd know that that person was there, and they'd know it wasn't fake because the only person that had that number was the pilot himself. No one else had it, not his colleagues, nobody. So we had a case, and I don't have the name, and if I did, I don't think I'd want to make it public because of privacy. I'm going to just make up a number. I'm just going to say 2792. It's a made-up number. And I'm going to say the pilot's name was Jones. Just make that up. John Jones, okay? And this is what happened. True story. We got a report in these files that the DIA had that said that there was a pilot named John Jones missing. His identifier number was 2792. And on the ground was near a prison in North Vietnam was the number 2792. Now, I did not take that on its face value. Dino and I went over to the intelligence agency and I said, I want to see the satellite image of those rocks and sticks that spelled out 2792. I want to see it. They said, well, you can't see it. And I said, no, I want to see it. I'm not leaving here until you show me it. So they had a huddle and they came out and they finally dragged it out. And so I look at it and I see 2792. I mean, it's not like somebody wrote it perfectly, but you can sure tell it's a 2 and it's a 7 and it's a 9 and it's a 2 and it's sticks and stones arranged in a field in very discreetly in a corner, not out in the middle of the field where everybody, but in the corner discreetly, we could see it. So I turned to the DIA debriefer and I said, we got a pilot missing. That's his number. That's his name. That name goes with that number. How can you say this is not real? He said, I don't see any number there. I said, what? He said, I don't see any number there, Senator. You don't see 2792. You're looking at that same thing. You don't see it. No, sir. So this is all true. So Dino and I left. I came back. And somebody had told us that there was a guy that used to work there at doing that imagery study. He's now retired. He was an independent contractor. I can't recall. He's deceased now, but I can't remember his name either. But anyway, we got a hold of him, and we brought him into my office, and I said, I want you to look at something. I'm not going to give you any information. All I want you to do is travel with me and with Dino over to the DIA. I want you to look at a map and tell me what you see. That's it. I'm not going to tell you another thing. He said, well, I can't do it for nothing. I said, how much you want? He said, $1,000. So Dino and I raised $1,000, not from the government, out of our own pockets, and we gave it to him. He said, okay, I'm hired and I'm going. So away we go. So we go over and they drag out the map, and they did not want to do it when they saw this guy because they know he worked there. So they took the same map out and they roll it out on the table and I said, what do you see? And he says, 2792. It's like, and the guy, and so I turned to the DIA guy, the analyst, the image guy, and I said, what do you see? He said, I don't see anything. I see a bunch of sticks. And so the guy that we hired said, what? Are you kidding me? I used to work here. You can't blow that smoke over me. And the guy said, well, I'm telling you, I don't see it. So that's where that came down. And I wanted that to be investigated further. Harry refused to do it. So I don't know. Here again, when you talk about one of the questions you asked me was, why did we say we had proof, but we couldn't establish? Where do you go from there? I mean, what's truth? I mean, how much more information? I mean, I just don't get it. And that, if you had said to me 2792, we didn't have a pilot missing with that number. We didn't have a pilot who's with that name and that number. I'd say, okay, fine. It was a mistake. Okay, I'll tell. But we had all of the above. Click, 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 click. All click. And yet, no. We were not allowed to pursue it. I was stopped. I couldn't do it. I
want to jump back a minute because we brushed over a lot of good information. when you were talking about the authenticator codes and stuff like that, that we know were real. Do you remember one that was brought up about a 52 being put on the ground?
The Walking J.
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah. Yes, I do. Some of those, they could very well be true. The only thing I would say there, John, is that I didn't. They were witnesses who said they saw this, and we did have some imagery on it, but they weren't as credible. I'm not saying they weren't credible, but I'm just saying they were not as credible as the one that I just referred to, where all the bullets were put together and all the pieces fit to make it, you know, the perfect. But yes, we had the Walking K, which was another way to identify, but it's not, Walking K is not as exact as an identifier number, but it was certainly very credible. Yes.
Yeah. What was interesting about that, there was actually about that time, a major with the Royal Lao Army that was being held prisoner there at that camp. And he had provided intelligence. Well, he was actually an intelligence major with the Royal Lao Army. And he provided statements to the DIA and stuff about Americans being held there and then being moved to a different camp and, you know, back and forth between a couple different camps. And that information never came out.
No.
Yeah, I was going to go back to these cluster maps because we never really got into them very much. And you were talking about how they were destroyed by the committee and stuff. Can you talk to us about how important those cluster maps were to you? You know, how it integrated all the signal intelligence, all the human intelligence, everything was combined into those cluster maps and how important they were.
Well, I think they were very important, John, because when you look at, when you go into this issue, you know, you try to peer in from the outside and look at all the stuff that's going on. And as you just correctly said, you had human intelligence, you had signal intelligence, you had, you know, eyewitness, you had all these, you had comments from the DIA, you had comments from the North Vietnamese, you had North Vietnamese Arvins, you had captured North Vietnamese soldiers, I'm sorry, South Vietnamese Arvins and captured North Vietnamese. You got all this information, Garwood, all of it, and it's spread all over the government, spread all over the place. So these guys on the committee that did my staff, that I hired every one of those people who all had a certain amount of talent in this area. And I personally interviewed most of them. And they were very good. And they would just simply take, there were literally thousands of live sighting reports. Some of them were pure garbage, just people trying to get out, refugees who were trying to get a way to get into the country. And we were able to throw those out and take, we started with the map by putting everything, anytime somebody said they saw somebody at point A, we put point A there and we put a pin in and let that cluster build, not trying to discriminate or differentiate between where they came from or what they were. Then after we got that done, we then zeroed in on the garbage stuff, pulled that out, and were able to just narrow it down to legitimate clusters. But Terry, his attitude and McCain was, we just needed to focus on one person at a time and one sighting at a time or one POW at a time, rather than looking at the whole picture. And you can get a picture, you know, if 100 people see somebody at a location, if 100 people say they saw a POW and one person says they saw a POW, there's a big difference in terms of the credibility for obvious reasons. So that's why the clusters were important. But they immediately, the Terry and his staff Francis Wienig. They never gave us a chance. The presentation was laughed at, mocked, and then all of that data, all of those maps, all those charts, all that classified information, all of it, and unclassified, some of it, destroyed. And how they got away with it, I don't know. I tried to get something done about it, couldn't do it.
Well, wasn't it true in almost every instance in those cluster maps when you started adding in the signal intercepts and the ledge distress signals that they all correlated to those clusters?
Yes, they did. Not all of them, but for the most part, yes, because we took everything. I don't think I could be wrong, but I don't believe, for example, the Baron 52 is in the cluster because that was a little bit later. So, yeah, it's not an absolute, but you know, by doing that, it was a very telling story. It was shocking because I kept saying, I want to see the cluster. I want to see the cluster. And the guys kept telling me, no, just stay back, Senator. Let us get finished and then show it to you. And when I came into that room and they showed me those clusters, I mean, I was shocked. I was literally shocked. And then I took some of the better reports, such as Garwood, the pilot identifier number that I talked about, and the Namorot raid, which we didn't talk about. We don't need to go into that. But when I put all that together, that's where the clusters were. The clusters were where Garwood said he saw them. The clusters were where Namorot raid was supposed to take place. The clusters were everywhere that we had significant live sighting and or intelligence reports. And then when you compare those clusters with the debunks, I have to say that a lot of the debunks were legitimate. They were liars. They were deep reefer. But many of them were not. And we took out the bad stuff and left only the good stuff in the presentation. We were honest about it. We put the garbage and we threw it out. We didn't try to, rig the system and make the cluster look like that when it should look like that. We didn't do any of that. We tried to be honest. We tried to be fair. And the reward we got for it was they destroyed all the evidence and refused to even consider it, and indeed laughed at it and mocked it. It was an effort made to a coordinated effort by Zwinig at the committee, Francis Wienig and John Kerry. And they would, when they made me, when I had questions other than what developed in a kind of an ad lib situation, which I had a lot of, but they wanted to know what my line of questioning was going to be. And I had to submit it to Kerry. And she took that information and gave it to the DIA before they testified. So my attitude on that is we're investigating them. We're not working with them. We're trying to find out what the hell happened. Why are we giving them our questions? They gave them all the questions they asked, and then they tried to give them everything I asked. So a lot of times I just held stuff back, and that's why I ad-libbed, because I wasn't damned if I was going to tell them everything. So I could at least get, that's why that exchange that I had with Destat was pretty testy, because he was lying, and I knew he was lying. He knew I knew he was lying. He knew I had done my homework, but he didn't know because I didn't tell Terry everything I was going to go into.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Baron 52 MIA Mystery Podcast. Join us on our next episode as we dive deeper into the Senate Select Committee hearings and the outcomes. Thank you for listening.
Above all in. Flag so proudly hailed, be proud of it.